Blog Talk Radio.
And here we are. This week, another explosion of an offshore oil platform in the Gulf of Mexico occurred earlier today. As a guess, that probably won't help the cause of more deep water drilling. The Israelis and the government representing Palestinians, other than in Gaza, agree to meet again. This way they can talk and talk and talk some more without agreeing on anything and still give the impression that they're actually doing something. In Kabul, Afghanistan, of course, the largest bank there was the victim of a depositor run for their money after fears arose that the bank might go bankrupt. The government took over the bank to assure the customers. The bank is partially owned by President Karzai's brother, who has been accused of being involved in official corruption. Because of the government takeover, the bank will apparently stay open. The president's brother, apparently, is too much of a pig to fail. A new study has demonstrated that a commonly used type of drug doubles the risk of esophageal cancer. This is a drug used to treat osteoporosis. Included in this class of drug are popular names like Fosamax and Boniva. I have this one body and this one life, and now it can be shorter. A judge ruled that President Obama wouldn't have to testify, and evidence about where he was born is irrelevant, in a case in which a U.S. Army flight surgeon wanted to bring in such evidence. The doctor, Lieutenant Colonel Terrence Lakin, refused to deploy to Afghanistan until he sees proof that the president was born in this country. In his court-martial, the physician is charged with disobeying a lawful order, dereliction of duty, and missing a movement. That's what it says. He may be a bum and a fascist, but if the charges are true, the poor man missed a movement. Oh, my God. Burger King is sold to a Brazilian-based venture capital group for a price that's a whopper. The good news is the purchase caused the stock price to go up. The bad news is that they're serving the same food they always have. Now, if you eat at Burger King or McDonald's and also take Boniva, you could more rapidly get to heaven if there is one. Remember, you'll never get to heaven if you break my heart, but you might manage if you congest my arteries. In California and North Carolina, school kids are being told they can't, I'm not making this one up, I swear. The school kids are being told they can't wear a bracelet that says, "I love boobies." The schools are telling them the bracelet's slogan is sexually suggestive. While it seemed that way to me at first, as well, it turns out they're from a group called Keep Abreast, whose design is to prevent breast cancer. On that basis, don't we all love boobies, other than the boobs who are trying to prevent the wearing of the bracelets? Growth in the last quarter's gross domestic product proved to be lower than originally believed, but guess what? It still grew. That means we're no longer in a recession. And the number of people who signed contracts to buy previously occupied housing was up in July by 5.2%. Now, that previously occupied housing means that it's not new construction. Now, the process is uneven, but the economy is improving. But you'd never know that if you watch TV news. Unfortunately, the unemployment report will be out tomorrow and will likely be misconstrued, misunderstood, and misdiagnosed. We'll prepare you for that. In Alaska, Republican incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski has conceded defeat to Palin-backed Joe Miller in the primary fight for the nomination. It's Alaska. Welcome to Family Feud. The White House, looking to boost the economy, says that a request for a second stimulus is off the table. We'll discuss with you why that's a mistake. Zsa Zsa Gabor returned home from the hospital. She's 93 years old and the subject of tabloid news stories about her allegedly pending death ever since she broke her hip. At 93, reporting about her pending death may not be correct, but it's a pretty good bet. No offense to nonagenarians and their surviving grandchildren. The last visit to the hospital occurred after her husband, number 9, found her lying on the floor and, according to news reports, couldn't rouse her. Maybe it's problems with him. I'm just saying. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to week 53 of Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be me. All that, news of the weird, this day in history, our guest, Larry Hancock, with more about the JFK assassination and the latest edition of his book. And first, we have an announcement, which we've made for the last several weeks. Our book, The Mobile Millionaire, is now available on Amazon. So go to, if you're interested in seeing an excerpt and seeing if the book is for you, you can go to Amazon.com, and in the search box, you can either put the name Jeff Bushman, oddly, or Mobile Millionaire as two separate words, and the book will come up. It is available in Kindle format. So you can download it to your Kindle should you decide to buy it, or read an excerpt. Likewise, can be downloaded to your Kindle. Or you can download the application for your PC or Mac as a Kindle reader, which you can then read on your computer, use on your computer. And that's basically that. Let's talk about some of these news stories, but first let me invite you, if you wish, to join us either now or when Larry Hancock joins us in about 20 minutes. I'm not good at exactly tracking the time, but he'll be joining us at 5 minutes before the hour. If you'd like to join us as well, the phone number is 347-994-3796, and that'll get you to us. And shortly after you phone in, we will take you on the air. We have no screeners here except your own good taste, and after a couple of seconds, if we determine that what you're saying should not be on the radio, we'll obviously cut you off, but most of the time we don't do that. In any event, let's talk about some of these news stories that we began discussing a moment ago. As we mentioned, there is an oil platform that exploded today. The good news is that nobody was killed, and apparently there were, according to the reports we saw, there were no life-threatening injuries, so that's obviously a good thing. And let's see, the Israelis, and I mentioned the government representing Palestinians other than in Gaza. That's because the government in Gaza is ruled by Hamas. And since both Israel and the United States government consider Hamas to be a terrorist group, they were not included in the talks. So no matter what happens, the talks, even if it resulted in some kind of settlement, which is unlikely in my opinion, is going to be of limited value by reason of the fact that the Hamas folks are not in it. This whole thing with the birther movement is incredibly lame. Every time these folks have come to court, they've been ruled out of order. Well, let me tell you what's going to happen. At some point in time, some idiot judge, and there are those, most of them, of course, are very good, learned people and all of that, but there are some idiots who are on the bench. Some idiot judge is going to say that this is an appropriate question to be resolved, and will insist on verification of President Obama's birth certificate. And once the Hawaiian Records Organization, whatever it's called, it could be the Bureau of Vital Statistics as it is in some states, it could be something else, but once they demonstrate that, once they testify that this is an accurate birth certificate, the case is over. And that'll happen, it'll be a matter of law. But it is so absurd on its face. And what's really absurd is when you see some of these Tea Party type people or just regular Republicans, they'll get on TV and they'll be asked, are you part of the birther movement? They'll all kind of duck the issue and say, well, I'm not, that's not, you know, his place of birth is less relevant than the kind of job he's doing, is what one woman said the other night. They'll say, well, I don't really think that's a major big deal, but if he wants to set it to rest, he should demonstrate. It's all nonsense, but what they're doing is they're trying to create the doubt, and they've been successful. There's a fair number of people who believe either that the president wasn't born in this country or that he's a Muslim or both. And this is after, during the campaign, everybody criticized him for staying in the church, which was presided over by Jeremiah Wright, saying that Jeremiah Wright was a racist and that the president shouldn't have been staying there once he knew what Wright was talking about. You can't accuse him of being too strong an adherent to a Christian church presided over by a minister who is arguably a racist and then say he did it because he's a Muslim? Okay. We talked as well about the GDP and the housing situation. The housing situation, automobiles, and jobs are all going to go up and down during a recovery. Now, the fact is that until housing and automobiles continue on an upward trend for a while, you will, in fact, not have better unemployment. Those are the two big movers in the economy. If you're unemployed, the unemployment rate is real serious for you, and I'm not suggesting it isn't or should be otherwise. But absent that kind of situation, unemployment always lags after the economy has improved, and in order for the economy to improve, you need positive housing statistics, both existing housing, which is the statistic we talked about having improved, and new housing. That is a very uneven situation. In the context of the economy, the White House announced that they're going to announce their initiatives on the economy in the next couple of days. But they also said that the stimulus, a second stimulus, is off the table. This is incredibly a bad choice, in my view, and that of a number of economists, including Paul Krugman, who is a Nobel Prize winner in economics. What's happened is there was an article in the New York Times the other day, which I hope you saw, and if not, you can probably still get it on the Internet, by putting in the name of its author, Laura Tyson, T-Y-S-O-N. She was an official in the Clinton administration, but she has a very broad background in economics and business. And she talked about the fact that the first stimulus, which has not all been spent yet, was probably responsible for there being many, many fewer jobs lost, and said, in fact, that there are a lot of jobs that have been either not lost or added to the economy because of the stimulus. She makes a very convincing case, more so than I can now. But more money in the economy can't help but create more jobs and improve the economy. It's been demonstrated by the fact that we now have growth in the GDP. Before the stimulus, we had contraction. We had a reduction in the gross domestic product. We had negative GDP growth. So it's pretty clear it's had an effect in spite of what all of the nutcases are trying to tell you. Now the president is talking about not putting stimulus in, and there's been conversation about trying to reduce the deficit. You don't try to reduce the deficit at a time of recession, just as you frankly don't try to raise taxes during a recession. It's a really, really bad idea, and we're talking about across-the-board tax increases. I have mixed feelings about eliminating the Bush tax cut, time does not really allow to go into detail here, nor does the prospect of keeping you awake. So in that context, let me just say that in the Great Depression, the economy was actually improving. A lot of, again, the right-wing nutcases will tell you that the thing that ended the Depression was World War II. That is flat out not true. The thing that ended the Depression was spending. Yes, deficit spending by the Congress and the President during the period of the 30s. And what happened was, beginning in 1934, the economy began improving because of all that spending, the WPA, all of the other government programs. And then, I'm pretty sure it was 1937, President Roosevelt decided, and got Congress to go along, that the deficits had grown too large and it was time to constrict spending. That's what they did. Guess what happened to the GDP? It went down. Things had been improving substantially, not to totally end the deprivation that had occurred, but there were vast improvements, and then they constricted spending and the economy went down. There is a relationship, folks, and the reason that more money in the economy can't help but improve the economy is that when there's more money available, more people buy more things, more businesses borrow. Now, we haven't seen a lot of business borrowing, but that's for other reasons. But you have had more money in the economy, and people are buying more things, and more employment's created. And as that virtuous cycle goes on, you come out of any restriction or constriction in the economy. And until such point as all of the factories are at full capacity, you have no inflation. I'm not suggesting we're not going to have inflation. As if you've been listening to this show for any length of time, you know that we expect inflation to happen, but not anytime soon, and particularly not if they restrict spending by trying to reduce the deficit. Worst thing you can do during a recession is to restrict government spending or raise taxes. Both of those things were done by Herbert Hoover. The rest of the story is not just history, but is very telling. Let's talk about News of the Weird. By the way, in about 9 minutes, make it 10, we should be joined by Larry Hancock, author of Someone Would Have Talked, about the Kennedy assassination and a couple of other things he's got going. And we'll talk more about that from the point at which we left the show, left the conversation last week, which, as a way of an ADD reminder, I should add that if you're listening to the show live, you can hear past shows, which are archived at the same site at which you joined us now, if you're like most people, unless you got the show in some other way. But the website is blogtalkradio.com/Jeff, J-E-F-F, hyphen Bushman, B-U-S-H-M-A-N. And you can hear basically all of our past shows, although you would have to be really without another thing to do in your life if you wanted to do that, but you could. And at the same time, if you are listening to this show in archive edition, you can join us live, either by phone or just by listening in, on Thursday evenings from 7:30 to 8:30 Pacific. That's 10:30 to 11:30 Eastern Time. We have some News of the Weird and This Date in History, so let me go ahead and get to some of that because Larry, as I say, will be joining us for a conversation in about 10 minutes. On this day in history, September 2nd, in 1666, the Great Fire of London broke out, and that destroyed much of the city, which they've since rebuilt a little bit. Get your thinking caps on, because there's going to be a very brief quiz. In 1789, the United States Treasury Department was established on September 2nd. Now, don't anybody use Google. Who was the first Secretary of the Treasury? I'll give you a little hint. He was a burr in the side of Thomas Jefferson. There are actually two hints there. But anyway, on this day, September 2nd, 1945, Japan's formal surrender went into effect, ending World War II. That was the one between... Never mind. Also in 1945, on this date, Ho Chi Minh declared Vietnam an independent republic. Not so fast, Mr. Ho. By the way, on that same date in 1969, he died. In 1963, on September 2nd, George Wallace, governor of Alabama, prevented the integration of Tuskegee High School by having his state's National Guard troops encircle the building. It's time now to go back to our quiz, which was a one-question quiz. Who was the first Secretary of the Treasury? Well, of course, the first Secretary of the Treasury served in the Washington administration, and I mentioned he was a burr on the side of Thomas Jefferson. He was, as most of you probably have guessed or already knew, Alexander Hamilton. The hint with the burr in the side is that Alexander Hamilton was killed in a duel with Aaron Burr, who, prior to that duel, had been a vice president under Thomas Jefferson, who was Hamilton's sworn enemy. The day after tomorrow, September 4th, is the anniversary of several events that you may find interesting. Each of the following occurred. 1781, the city of Los Angeles was created, and the next day they invented smog. In 1888, George Eastman patented his roll film camera and registered the Kodak name. I have to tell you a quick story a friend of mine told me today. Just recently moved, and his 14-year-old son was helping unpack when he ran across an old camera. And next to the old camera was a cylinder of 35-millimeter film. For those of you who have never used it, 35-millimeter film, whether color or black and white, came in a metal cylinder, and you would take the end of it to put it through over a series of sprockets and wind it to take pictures and advance the film. So the 14-year-old son held up the camera and held up the cylinder, presumably Kodachrome, Kodacolor, Ektachrome, whatever it was, and he said, "Dad, I know this is a camera, but what's this metal thing?" He had never seen a roll of film because, of course, all of his conscious life, we've had digital cameras. And all you, well, those of you who don't know, a digital camera records your pictures on a memory card, which can then be loaded into a computer or used to develop your pictures. But anyway, that's the reference there. In 1957, on September 4th, which is 2 days from today, not 1957, of course, but September 4th, in 1957, speaking of integration, 9 African-American students were denied entry to Little Rock's Central High School after then-Governor Orville Faubus used the same method that Governor Wallace had used. He blocked entry with National Guard troops. And after that, President Eisenhower demonstrated leadership and, I would add, heroism. Let me tell you what President Eisenhower did, for those of you who don't know. He went ahead and ordered Army troops to Little Rock. And the Army troops essentially confronted the National Guard troops and got them to exit so that the African-American students could attend high school in Little Rock. The reason I said that, it's obvious why it was leadership, but the reason it was heroism is because a number of Republicans who may not have been actively against integration, though some were not in favor of the federal government telling a state what to do. Eisenhower, however, realized that what was happening was wrong, was contrary to the law. 3 years earlier, in 1954, the United States Supreme Court had decided the case of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka and had ruled that schools had to be integrated with all deliberate speed. Of course, all deliberate speed is such that in 2010 it still hasn't happened, but that's a whole other story. But Eisenhower took seriously the rule of law, and whether he agreed with it or not, knew that under the Constitution it was his duty to enforce the law, and he did it. And whatever else you think of Eisenhower, he deserves our admiration for that. In about 2 minutes, we'll be joined by Larry Hancock and you, if you wish to, at 347-994-3796. In news of the weird, this first story is actually about someone you've heard of, Terry Nichols. In the event you don't remember that name, he was an accomplice and participant in the Oklahoma City bombing, though I couldn't honestly recall what year that was. He is serving a life sentence at the Supermax Federal Prison in Colorado. And he had just recently ended a third hunger strike, or the third hunger strike this year, protesting food quality. He says that lack of fiber in the diet causes him chronic constipation, bleeding, and hemorrhoids, and thus disrespects God's holy temple, which is what he calls his body. I hope he doesn't have osteoporosis. never mind. Last week, we reported on a practice in one African country, which also came from News of the Weird, where parents were paying people to force-feed their daughters so that the daughters would become fat and therefore desirable as marriage partners. Now it turns out that in some parts of Cameroon, which is another country in Africa, for those of you who don't know, parents iron their daughters' breasts to make them more flat-chested and therefore less sexually desirable. Nonetheless, the pregnancy rate for teenage girls remains very high in Cameroon. You know, whether you're being force-fed or you're having your breasts ironed, it's probably not a good idea to be a young girl or a teenage girl in Africa, at least in the two countries we've talked about. Very, very, and this doesn't even talk about, what do they call it, female circumcision, which occurs in some countries on that continent. Just awful. Anyway, so that's the story there. And we are, if my board is correct, we are now joined by Larry Hancock. Are you there, Larry?
Good evening, Jeff.
Good evening. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good, good. For those of you who weren't with us last week, Larry was with us because the new edition of his book, Someone Would Have Talked, is coming out. And that's about the JFK assassination. And it is it out now, or is it coming out in a week or two now?
It's still a week or two. I spent the day going through the final author's, you know, edit review. This is the one where if you miss it, it's your fault for sure.
Yeah.
So this is, I mean, this is the last step. It should be ready to go to print, I would hope, by the end of next week.
Terrific.
I'm doing that. At the same time, I started, the editor's going through the first two chapters of the MLK book, and this is, no one should ever try to do two books being edited at the same time.
Yeah, probably not, because you could end up with discovering that John F. Kennedy was a preacher at Ebenezer Baptist Church, if you're not careful.
Either that or my head will explode.
Yes, that might be a bad choice under the circumstances of what happened in Dallas. But the name of the MLK book is?
Seeking Armageddon.
Okay. And both books and their progress towards publication will be something that someone can find out about at your website, the address of which is?
www.larry-hancock.com.
Mm-hmm.
And
the
book Armageddon is available for pre-order on Amazon now.
So Amazon.com, and you can look up in the search box either Seeking Armageddon or Larry Hancock.
Yep, that's right.
And you'll find it. And the prior edition of Someone Would Have Taught, is that also available on Amazon?
It is, yes.
Okay. On the other hand, you may want to wait for a couple of weeks on that one because the newer edition is coming out, and you have found a lot more stuff, not necessarily found, but you have gone through a lot more stuff because of the documents that have been getting released.
I have, and the third edition will definitely be longer.
Okay.
When you're talking about a 630-page book and you say be longer, you know, that could be a good thing or not, I guess, but...
Well, it's good for a couple of reasons. First off, there's a lot more information in it, and secondly, if you don't get any other exercise, this is a way of building up your arms.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some more of the stuff that you have detailed in your book. But I was speaking to a friend of mine who normally listens to the show when you're on, at least. And he said to me, ask him, okay, because he's going to be, I hate to mention this because people may leave and go watch their TVs if they're sports fans, but apparently this is the opening night for college football.
It is.
And so... Yeah, and so this friend of mine who's got some kind of service has, and I'm not a football fan, but he's got something like 17 different games going on that he can flip between. So he's watching those, so he won't hear this until he listens to the recording. But he said, ask him if there's any real strong documentation about mafia involvement. So I thought that's as good a place to start as any other, so why don't you go ahead and let us know about that?
You bet. I think... The answer is there's no really strong organization for mafia in terms of the syndicate or the national organized network. I mean, in reality, you know, the national syndicate is not going to sit back and take that kind of risk. On the other hand, there is good evidence that certain individuals, John Roselli being probably the one of most interest, who was very well connected in the gambling world in Las Vegas and the L.A. film industry, connected to Lansky, that he had a role in the conspiracy. And then actually the reason he had a role was that he had been recruited by the CIA to work on Castro assassination projects. And that brought him into contact with the people that we've been talking about. And Roselli probably was the conduit to Jack Ruby.
Okay, well, let's back up a couple of steps so folks can catch up. First off, Castro was the victim of a long series of assassination plots by the CIA, probably at least in the beginning with Kennedy's knowledge, Jack Kennedy's knowledge. Later, it's an open question. But the mafia, you indicate, and this is fairly widely known and acknowledged, was recruited by the CIA because it was thought that these guys would be great to go ahead and do the hit, so to speak, on Castro. And they were remarkably unsuccessful, right? Well, obviously, Castro's still alive, but go ahead with, you know some of the
stories. They were. The reason, though, that it's a little different than that, it wasn't. They weren't recruited for their professional expertise. They were recruited because the agency, when this started, which was well before the Bay of Pigs, they didn't want an executive action against a leader of a foreign country that would point back to them. And Castro had already, there had actually been gambling network attempts on Castro's life already. When he had come to the UN, there was a plot sponsored by some ex-gamblers out of Vegas to kill him in New York City. So it was well known that the guys that had been kicked out of Cuban gambling would like to take Castro out. And the reason they approached Roselli was that they thought, A, that these people would have contacts with their old employees and people inside Havana to use in a plot, but also, if it happened, it would be very easy for them to take the rap.
Right. And let's add to the mix, prior to 1959, when Castro took over in Cuba, the leader there, who was Batista, allowed gambling interests there, and those gambling in, the gambling business there was run essentially by the mafia. Did I got that right?
It was. It was, well, it was, it was run by mafia dons, if you want. Lansky, Dalitz out of the Midwest, out of Detroit, or, Cleveland, Traficante, all of, everybody that had a casino in Vegas had a casino in Havana. And obviously they had a lot of negotiations among each other as to how they were going to split that up.
Right. Now, so in terms of Roselli, would you call him the principal mover among those who were at least part of the mafia? Was he the principal mover in terms of their side of the equation for the assassination?
Definitely, I would say so. He was, because the CIA folks that we've been talking about knew him, and because they lacked one big thing. They had people that knew how to shoot people. They'd been training these guys to kill Castro for years, but they really didn't have any assets inside the United States. You know, they're oriented outside. So they didn't have any contacts in Dallas. They didn't know the ground in Dallas. They needed somebody local like Ruby. And so Roselli was a way to get in touch with people that would be useful in Dallas. And,
Now, I was going to ask you, you know, Ruby, for those who read nothing more than the summary of the Warren Commission report, or who know nothing except what they learned in junior high school and high school about the Kennedy assassination, Jack Ruby is a figure who was crazed and so upset by the killing, allegedly, of the president by Lee Harvey Oswald that he had this undeniable urge to take action, and he went into the base, I guess it was the basement, but at least into the building of the police department in Dallas and pulled out a gun and shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald and was jailed and died in prison. That's all they know. Talk to us for a minute about what the real involvement of Jack Ruby was in terms of the whole, the setup and the aftermath.
Sure. And what you've just described is what's generally known as the Jackie alibi. In other words, at his trial, Jack Lawyer offered the point that he was so emotionally distraught that he didn't want to see Jackie Kennedy come back to Dallas to a trial, so he made sure there wasn't one. There are two things that kind of undermine that alibi. One is that he later admitted to another lawyer that his first lawyer had given that to him. That, you know, it's kind of like, okay, this is the way we're going to play it, Jack. So he admitted that that was false. And B, it's sort of undermined by the fact that if he was that interested in the president and, you know, that much into the president, at the time of the motorcade, he supposedly wasn't even watching it. He was a couple of blocks away at a news office placing an ad for his club. So it's it's sort of hard to translate that. It's also undermined by the fact that an informant in Dallas is actually on record as having been told by Ruby the day before that it would really be good if he had time to go downtown and get on the motorcade route and watch the fireworks. Which, again,
suggests he knew what was going to happen.
Certainly, there's every reason to feel that Ruby had done some groundwork. Ruby had contacts within the police department. He knew cops that could be used for minor things if necessary. there's no doubt at this point in time that he was a conduit into the police department. And if you needed information about the motorcade route or the security or who was going to be stationed where, Ruby would be able to find that kind of information. I don't think there's, you know, there's nothing that indicates that he was really a big part of the plot, just an accessory, basically.
Well, two things. One is I was going to tell you something, and then I have a question for you. The first thing that I'm going to tell you, I'll bet you've never run across, but I remember as a kid doing a report on this, I think, or doing some reading on my own. There was a magazine, I don't remember now whether it was The Nation or The Progressive or one of those, you know, not like the magazines you read because you're not a lefty, and I was.
And I'm out of Oklahoma.
And you're in Oklahoma, that's right. So, anyway, but whatever it was, I wouldn't describe it as I was a lefty, but I read the magazines. But what I was going to say is that the there was one of those magazines that came out, and somebody had done this study and had come to the belief that Ruby, this is before the naysayers on the Warren Commission came out, but had the belief that Jack Ruby acted out of anger because of a homosexual desire he had for President Kennedy. Now, that's a stretch.
I have heard that one, yes.
Oh, have you?
I didn't spend too much time on that one.
but, you know, okay. In any event, the thing I was going to ask you is, wasn't there some discussion, my memory may be flawed here, but I thought I remembered some discussion that Ruby was in New Orleans around the time of the planning of the assassination, about which Jim Garrison found out and was involved in the prosecution, or that there were some of these characters who were involved at his club, the Carousel Club in Dallas, and that he in some fashion may have known Oswald prior to the assassination. Do you know anything about that?
Several reports by people that had worked at the club and had been around the club that Oswald had actually been in the Carousel Club. You know, there were plenty of those, and that may very well have been true. From what we know, there's no reason to think that Ruby would have been scared to associate with Oswald. He was just doing some minor handling, some minor contacts, so finding him in touch with Oswald would probably not have been a big deal. But the other thing that you mentioned is that indeed Ruby was in New Orleans. There are two times that Ruby kind of goes missing, that his whereabouts really aren't accounted for. And in one of those times, he went to New Orleans, and there is also a report from an FBI agent that he went on to Miami, and that an FBI surveillance report existed showing him meeting with Roselli in Miami.
Hmm.
And
again, another connection.
And amazingly enough, the FBI agent, when he went back to get a hard... And he found this report when these guys were doing an investigation of Roselli's death. When they went back to kind of try to get a copy of the file, it was not available. But it's not the first time we've run into that. In any event, so you can't support it with a hard document. But one of the things that... An interesting thing in regard to Roselli is we now have probably 8,000 to 10,000 pages of FBI surveillance on Roselli. He was a prime target. The only thing that we don't have, and the only file that is totally missing, that we know there was one because it's copied, is his file out of Miami. And that is just totally gone. So
Yeah, now that suggests either that, my God, what a strange occurrence, it got lost, or that someone has gotten rid of it and suppressed it because what he was doing in Miami was related to, if not the Kennedy assassination, at least something that someone doesn't want known.
There are a lot of that sort of stuff that literally would have just forced an investigation. You'd have to answer a question of why Roselli was with Ruby, and they just really didn't want to go down that road.
Crazy. Did you find anything, or have you seen anything related to the folks who were later involved, or first off, who may have been involved in the Bay of Pigs and then were later involved in Watergate?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. there were a couple of people that carried on through the whole process that were very, Frank Sturgis being one of them, mm-hmm. Sturgis Fiorini, and Martinez, who had been a CIA boat guide, that were very involved in a lot of these anti-Castro operations that ended up at the Watergate. And basically, the interesting point about that, probably not so much in regard to the Kennedy conspiracy, is it illustrates the fact that CIA officers who were trusted could essentially mm-hmm. go in and make use of CIA assets and nobody ask any questions. It's interesting, we now have the documents that when Hunt recruited Bernard Barker, another one mm-hmm. of the Miami CIA guys for the Watergate, that some of these guys reported back to their supervisors and said, well, this Hunt fellow has contacted me and wants me to go do this, what should I do? And the mm-hmm. response was, well, we really don't know what he's doing, so you're on your own. And so that is something that we think we see in the conspiracy, that officers that were well-placed and respected could use assets
right.
unofficially. And nobody asked questions. It's a great thing when you've got deniability of operations because
right.
people don't ask questions. And then afterwards, they really don't ask questions.
Sure. Well, and implied in what you said, or what I'm inferring from what you said, is that if the CIA didn't want Hunt to use the CIA operatives, they would have said, Hunt is acting on his own, and this is not something you should get involved in. But when they say, you're on your own, they're basically saying, make your decision, do what you want, right?
Yep, absolutely. And in this case, in some of the memos, it appears that, of course, the local people in Miami at the time would have had no idea to know what Hunt was involved in. And we also know at that point in time, at the Watergate point in time, even though he was not officially a CIA officer, Hunt was receiving support from the agency. They were giving him fake credentials. And so it gets to be very nebulous, you know, when someone's working, mm-hmm. even when they're supposedly retired. You know, that's the caveat is no one ever retires from the agency.
That's right. Well, talk a little more about E. Howard Hunt. And I'm pretty sure he was the guy who ended up filing a lawsuit against a newspaper. I don't know if you're familiar with that or if we've talked about it before. It was either Hunt or McCourt. I think it was Hunt. But talk about what his background is and his involvement in I think he was involved in Bay of Pigs. You'll know that better than I do, as well as the Kennedy assassination. His name became familiar to most of the public in the United States following the Watergate incident in which he was involved. But talk about him generally in this history.
He did file, because he had been named in a book as a participant in the JFK conspiracy, and Hunt mm-hmm. brought some of it on himself because he would frequently tease reporters about all that he knew that he couldn't talk about, you know, and make remarks mm-hmm. like, if you gave me $1 million, I could tell you killed JFK. So he played those games. But mm-hmm. Hunt was an agency old-timer, but the interesting thing is the reason Hunt was actually admired within the agency is Hunt also wrote spy novels. And he
right.
wrote popular spy adventure novels. You know, they're the kind of things that if you were a CIA officer, you would like to be doing that kind of stuff, you know.
Right.
And the good guys always win, and they get the girls, and so on and so forth. So, you know, they really liked having Hunt around because he wrote good stuff, but as a CIA officer, he wasn't nearly as effective. He had bad habits about drinking. He had bad habits of leaving stuff around. One time the FBI got a report of, you know, there's some plotting going on in his motel. These people have heard people talking next door about these secret missions. And, yeah, it was Hunt, and he was having a meeting with some Cuban exiles. And so if you pull this file, you know, even though he was well thought of in general, tradecraft not very good, as you saw at Watergate. You know, it's sort of
mm-hmm.
like he talked a good game, but when he was doing it, it wasn't quite so good.
He was kind of clumsy.
Yeah, he was definitely clumsy. And generally, he thought better of probably by senior agency officers than the people that he was working with. And he had a real attitude. He got pulled off the Bay of Pigs project right before it happened because mm-hmm. he he had such strong political views that he refused to work with any except the most ultra-right of the exiles, the old Batista folks.
Right.
And actually, Hunt himself may have been, this is a strange story, but he may have been responsible for the Bay of Pigs failure, because it's now known that one of Roselli's Castro assassination plots was
mm-hmm.
supposed to poison Castro right before the Bay of Pigs.
Right.
And they were all set up to do it, and probably it would have happened, except the guy that was supposed to deliver the middleman was named Verona, and Hunt locked him up before the Bay
Why?
Of Pigs because he was suspicious of several of these exiles talking. So he didn't
mm-hmm.
want them to talk or maybe do anything, so he had them all locked up in a safe house, and so the whole poison plot.
Poison.
Made. Yeah.
And Castro, I guess we should probably explain for the younger listeners who are not historically aware, and that not that all younger listeners will be, but for those of you who are not historically aware, the Bay of Pigs occurred in 1961 and was a failed effort to invade Cuba with Cuban exiles who were against Castro, basically invade Cuba. These were troops who were what you would call an insurrectionist, who were trained by the CIA to go in and start fighting against Castro's troops on the assumption and belief that those opposed to Castro on the island would arise and join the revolutionaries and basically overthrow Fidel Castro. And the problems with that plan were several, including that there weren't that many people who were against Castro in 1961 on the island of Cuba. And the other fact is that these guys, just there were not enough of them to really do a job. Those who favor the exiles and who dislike Kennedy say that one of the reasons for the failure is that the United States failed to provide air cover with airplanes. Have I missed anything?
No, the one thing that we know now that is not stated and you won't find mentioned is that even the agency military leaders, the operational leaders that were in charge of making the attack, went
mm-hmm.
to their boss about 3 weeks before the invasion and literally said, this is not going to happen. It can't work. Don't make us do this. And they were told not to worry about it and, you know, that their concerns would be communicated and just to go right on. And
keep on, yeah.
The Inspector General's report that really looked at the thing totally said it was, well, if you think about it a minute, what does the CIA know about launching a major maritime assault on the beach?
Right.
And is
not
this what they really
done.
Were set up to do? They kept trying to do things that they really didn't have the expertise for.
Right. Right. And Hunt, to complete the circle of the story we both alluded to a minute ago, Hunt went ahead and sued. You said it was a book. I thought it was a newspaper, but whatever it was, Hunt sued for libel. The interesting part is that the person who was sued called to act as his attorney, Mark Lane.
Yes.
Mark Lane wrote one of the early books questioning the validity of the Warren Commission report. Mark Lane had been a state assemblyman in New York and was a lawyer and wrote the book called Rush to Judgment. And he defended this publisher. And in libel cases, there are a couple of different defenses that they can use. One is that the person talked about is a public figure. You're familiar with that, I trust.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and if you use that defense, which is sometimes called the Sullivan case, is that the person who is quote-unquote libeled can't really sue because being a public figure, you have to prove actual malice or reckless disregard of the truth. That's an easier case to defend, according to lawyers, than the other defense, which is that the writer or publisher told the truth. Well, the writer or publisher, I'm not sure which it was, went ahead and insisted that Lane defend based on the fact that what was said about Hunt being involved in the Kennedy assassination was true. That is, in fact, what he did. They brought in all kinds of evidence, which is years and years after Lane had written Rush to Judgment. And so a lot of the stuff was out there. And in fact, the jury decided in favor of Lane's client that in fact he was not guilty of libel or liable for libel, because what he had said about Hunt being involved in the planning of the assassination of JFK was true.
And I think you're right, Jeff. It was not a book. It was a tabloid,
okay,
or a perhaps not a newspaper, but something of that nature. And they did,
okay,
find for conspiracy. The interesting thing, and this just to provide a little balance to it, though, the major thing that seems to have convinced the jury was that Lane really mousetrapped Hunt, and basically he forced Hunt into a position of saying, you know, why he thought this had been so damaging to him, because Hunt needs to really claim some severe damages against just this article. And Hunt started making this huge case that his family was traumatized by it, and his family was traumatized by the fact that, you know, he was involved and he was in Dallas and he was part of this attack. And Lane had already obtained testimony that as part of his alibi, Hunt was with his family in D.C. that afternoon. So Lane trapped him on the stand and said, well, Howard, how can it be that they're so traumatized because you were there watching TV with them? They know it's not you. And that just, it's kind of like you just fold your tent and, you know, retreat into the sunset because you've been had.
Yeah.
Now, that's a real good that was true, and that's a real good story. Mm-hmm. But one thing that you have to say about Howard Hunt was he was 100% agency. He would never, he'd never compromise the agency, and we now know why he wouldn't admit what he was doing on November 22nd, because he wasn't at home with the kids. He went to a meeting, because we have the records of the meeting. There were a series of meetings going on in D.C. about a revolt and a coup that was going to be staged against Castro, and Hunt was part of that task group, as the AM World Project, and he was specifically the representative to our teammate, Manuel Artemi, who was the head of the project, and he was really the only CI officer that our teammate trusted. Now, interestingly enough, that project never really died, and Hunt really, my presumption is, there was no way that Hunt was ever going to disclose that project. So it looks like he literally sucked it up and, in defense of the agency, let himself be found guilty.
Or found to be, in fact, a member of the conspiracy.
Right.
Because it wasn't a crime he was charged with. But the other thing is, isn't he the guy, and again, you can correct, I'm not sure you would know this, it's not directly related to the Kennedy assassination, but isn't he also the guy who wouldn't talk to the judge who was effectively convicting all of these Watergate conspirators? He just basically pleaded guilty and went to jail.
He pleaded guilty and went to jail. And this is not my area of expertise.
Yeah, mine
but
either.
I don't
have any.
It appears from what I've read about it that part of his not talking was bargaining for defense funds for everybody. And he was really bargaining with the president for money for their defense funds. And you have to say, like I said, if Hunt was anything, he was loyal. Whatever you say about his tradecraft or his ethics or morals or whatever, he was intensely loyal. And he was willing to let himself, you know, pretty much go head to head and say, look, you're gonna pay money for all of these people, and I'm not going to turn on any of them.
And in effect, to some extent, that's what happened. But going back to the Kennedy assassination, where are we in terms of, I mean, your book obviously is part of the process. Where are we in terms of, first a comment. We obviously have not convicted anybody of conspiring to kill the president. Those efforts were thwarted in New Orleans when Garrison tried it. The Assassinations Committee's work was cut short. By the Assassination Committee, I'm referring to the one that was that of the House, not the Warren Commission, which was a joke. What are the prospects? I mean, all these people are dying of natural causes now, too.
Yeah, where we really are, and it's a strange thing, if you really think about it, we are waiting for the Justice Department. And the reason I say a strange thing is the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Congressional Committee, reported out findings of conspiracy in the assassination.
And what year was that that report came out?
Oh, late 70s, 78, okay, something like that. Somebody's going to correct me, but it would have been the late 70s. And they reported out a finding of conspiracy and essentially said, all right, it's kind of like a grand jury thing. The grand jury finds evidence of conspiracy, but you have to turn it off to legal prosecution. And they went to the Justice Department and said, okay, we'll hand our stuff over to you. Now, we need a real criminal investigation and, real prosecution. And Justice did not respond. And Justice is still not. At any given time, the Justice Department could choose to respond and actually go back and open the case. At this point in time, I have talked to investigators, Gayton Fonzie, one of the principal investigators for the HSCA, who has told me basically if he had the kind of material we had now, they would have gone and you could prosecute the case. And that was when the CIA was denying things to him that we now have the documents on.
Okay, we've got about 4 minutes. Let me ask you a headline question. Again, the time has flown. Let me ask you a headline question. If the Justice Department were today going to initiate a prosecution, against whom would they begin initiating that prosecution?
Well, your point was well taken in that a lot of the principals that would have been named are deceased, and that's a real trap. In all honesty, I think they would probably start, and we have the chairman, Blakey, of the House Select Committee on record, saying that with some of the things that have been taken to him by researchers, that where he would start would be with charges of obstruction of justice, that he would actually go back and file against certain agencies like the CIA charges of obstruction of justice. And take those charges to go to their officers to recall some of the people that were serving at the time and take them on to the stand to release certain documents. I mean, we've discussed the fact that one of the major players that the CIA seconded to the House Select Committee is now known to have been a case officer for the group that was interacting with Lee Oswald in New Orleans in 1963. And he should have known all about New Orleans, and he chose not to share that with the HSCA. Blakey considers that obstruction of justice.
Sure it is, and perhaps perjury, depending on what question was asked.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to point out, we have 2 minutes. I want to get your website before people again. It's larry-hancock.com, correct?
Yes.
And you can put in Larry Hancock's name or someone would have talked into the search box on Amazon.com and find his books. We've got about probably a minute and three quarters. Go ahead.
Answer your question, I am not sure that there are people that are named in these records that if justice began an investigation, that they would call these people and take their testimony. I'm not sure I don't think you'd immediately jump to the prosecution stage. You first got to reinvestigate it. And there are names in my book that you would immediately call in and put under oath and start taking testimony. So I don't... First, you got to build an investigation again. And is it too late to do it at this point in time?
Maybe.
It's almost too late.
Yeah. Well, speaking of too late, I'm going to have to let you go. We're going to have to do this again, not next week, because I have people lined up. But we're going to have to do this again, maybe in a few weeks or a month or so. We'll talk, and we'll come back on, and we'll talk about who do we indict, or who do we investigate first.
Sounds good to me.
Anyway.
Who gets called? All right, thanks, Jeff.
That's right. All right, Larry Hancock joins us, and you can find his book, as we indicated, larry-hancock.com. I'll talk to you later, Larry. Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Good night. And for those of you who are listening to us, I thank you. As you heard when we were on last week was our one-year anniversary of doing the show. We shall continue until we get it right. Thank you for joining us. We want to thank the producer of the show, Autumn Lees Bushman, who is lying in her dog bed. waiting for the show to end so we can go do something else. Again, thank you very much. Tell your friends, warn your enemies to listen to the show, and we'll join you next week. Same bad time, same bad station. Have a great week, everybody. Talk to you then. Good night.